Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The 2010 NHL and NBA titles are still up for grabs, but not for long. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest postseason news, also the long-awaited story behind the NBA betting scandal, and the Spanish national soccer team visits the shores of North America. Also ahead, fans of immortal Tampa Bay Rays outfielder Sam Fold hold a day of celebration and cape-wearing, teammate Johnny Damon among them.
We don't look at the cape as being a joke. I mean, we really look at Sam as being superhuman.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you score 8, it's really great. But when it's said and done, you might wish you had stayed on 6 if then you lose by 1. The Vancouver Canucks shut out the Boston Bruins 1-0 in Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Finals last night. Vancouver, which had lost the previous two games by scores of 8-1 and 4-0, now leads the series 3-2. Game 6 will transpire Monday night in Boston. The home team has yet to lose in this series. Since Game 3, the finals have not included Nathan Horton of the Bruins, who is recovering from a concussion. Aaron Rome has been missing from the Vancouver lineup since he was the one who hit Horton. He was suspended for 4 games. Joining me now to talk about the impact of impacts on this final series is Ron Borges, who writes about the NHL for the Boston Herald. Ron, welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be here, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. The NHL recently created Rule 48 to discourage lateral or blindside hits to the head. Though Aaron Rome was suspended, it was not for violating that rule. What was it for?
Well, technically it was for a late hit, which they said was about a second late. I don't know how they determined that, but it was about 3 strides after Nathan Horton had passed the puck to his left, and he was still looking at the pass. There's no question it was a late hit, but it didn't fall under Rule 48.
Rome's teammates and his coach have said that Rome's 4-game suspension was too severe. What's their defense?
That they're hockey players and it was their guy. That's about it. It was, in the opinion of a lot of hockey people, to be honest, a borderline call. Even Tony Amonte, the Massachusetts guy who was such a great player for so long, that's the way he looked at it, and he was kind of unbiased about it, and so did a lot of other people. It was a situation where he wasn't coming really directly from the side, although he wasn't right in front of Horton either, but that's how they got around the Rule 48. They said it wasn't a blindside hit. And a lot of the argument was based on, this isn't the ice capades, you don't skate around with your head down. You know you're going to get hit, especially in the Stanley Cup Finals. So I think this is part of the problem, though, Bill. They justify these kind of hits, even when they lead to these kind of injuries.
Vancouver won the first 2 games of this series, and after Nathan Horton was knocked out of Game 3, the series changed dramatically. Are we looking at cause and effect here?
Well, you know, we're myth makers here in the world of sports, so that's certainly what it's been turned into. And to a degree, although it knocked out Horton, it seemed to wake up his teammates who had been really not playing their style in the first 2 games, and it seemed like they really got energized. And the Canucks, I think, shriveled a bit. Some of their players are not exactly known as hard-nosed guys, and maybe they looked at that hit and said, I'm not sure I want to be part of that. Certainly you could see it in Game 3. From that moment on, every Canuck was looking around waiting for some Bruin to unload on him from behind.
Bruins defenseman Sean Thornton told you, it's on the players to stop hurting each other. Do you sense a change in attitude among the players regarding their responsibility for each other's health and safety?
Unfortunately, not too much. I mean, I think some players, like Sean, who is a noted sort of tough guy himself but doesn't take those kind of shots, are starting to get it. But enough of them, you know, sort of viewed it as a close call, and everybody sort of exonerated Rome after the fact, saying, well, you know, he didn't intend to hurt him, blah, 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 blah. So I think that they're not quite getting it yet, but the league is getting it, because you can't keep losing stars like Sidney Crosby, like Mark Savard, like Patrice Bergeron, now like Nathan Horton, and continue to sell your league to the public. So they know something has to be done. Convincing the players is going to be a little more difficult.
So you're suggesting Sean Thornton's attitude is not exactly representative?
No, I don't think it is. Earlier in the year, Andrew Ferentz, a defenseman for the Bruins, stood up after his teammate Daniel Pie was suspended for a similar type of hit. He stood up and said, look, this hit was wrong. And he was immediately called in the coach's office, and the coach wanted to know exactly what was he doing. So that's sort of what you're up against.
This week, NHL general managers met and proposed a broader interpretation of Rule 48, recommending that the term blindside be eliminated from the rule. Is this a step in the right direction?
Yes, it is. It certainly is. And I think it was because of just this kind of hit where, you know, technically they could get away with saying it wasn't a blindside hit, but it's the kind of hit that they want to take out of the game. Unfortunately, selling it to the people who run hockey and to a lot of the fans is going to be difficult. I mean, the night that it happened, one of the analysts on CNC broadcasting up in Canada said it was Horton's fault for not paying attention. So as long as you sort of put it on the victim, then you're going to have a long road.
Some have criticized the way the league disciplines players. Ron, can we depend on the incoming league disciplinarian, Brendan Shanahan, to clean up what some consider an administrative mess?
I think he's going to try. Certainly they have made public announcements and private announcements to the general managers and the coaches that next year is going to be a new day, and they're going to go more to the NFL model of you're guilty until proven innocent sort of thing. And my guess would be the players at that point might begin to adjust their game, you know, when it starts to cost them money. And when their own coaches are starting to say, we can't afford to be losing people because you want to run somebody down. And you could see the effect on the Canucks in Game 4. They had to bring up a defense who hadn't played since March. And quite frankly, he was dreadful. And that's probably underusing the meaning of the word dreadful. And that hurt them. So when you get into that kind of situation, you say, now, wait a minute, is this really worth it?
Ron Borges writes about the NHL for the Boston Herald. Ron, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Glad to do it, Bill.
By mid-April, speedy outfielder Sam Fold was leading the league in hitting at .396. By late April, his acrobatic catches had sent more than one batter back to the dugout mumbling. Recently, the Rays honored Tampa's latest folk hero during Super Sam Sunday, when 10,000 blue superhero capes fluttered in the imaginary breezes inside the dome Tropicana Field. Bobby O'Brien of WUSF in Tampa has the story of the legend of Sam Fold.
Get a load of this caper, if you will.
How about that? Johnny Damon taking up the lineup card in a cape. You just gotta love the Rays version of Major League Baseball.
Those are Rays TV announcers Dwayne Statz and Brian Anderson covering the pregame warm-up of Super Sam Cape Day 2 weeks ago. On that day, Rays designated hitter Johnny Damon draped the kid-sized sky blue Super Sam cape over his broad shoulders as he strode to home plate before the game. Damon, who had been replaced by Sam Fold in left field, was having a little fun with his teammate, but he also did it as a sign of respect.
We don't look at the cape as being a joke. I mean, we really look at Sam as being superhuman. I mean, the plays he's been able to make for our team, and he's a big reason why our team got back on track.
But Tampa Tribune sports reporter Roger Mooney says the legend of Sam Fold was born on April 11th, when Fold helped the Rays beat division rival Red Sox in Fenway Park.
Yeah, this team wasn't winning until he got into the lineup. And then, he has the big night in Boston. He goes 4-for-4. He's a single shy of hitting for the Cyclone. He hits a double. More people, I think, in society are closer to being Sam Fold than they are being Evan Longoria. So that's kind of what everybody kind of latched on to.
It was during that 4-for-4 game that Fold had the chance to hit for the cycle. All he needed was a single. During his fourth at bat, he hit an obvious double. His teammates watched. TV announcers speculated. Fold said there was no hesitation in his stride and headed for second base.
To me, it was a no-brainer. I just felt like if I had done that, it would have disrespected the Red Sox and just kind of the game. It was a sure double, and I don't think, the cycle is a cool thing, but it's just a statistical anomaly, and I'm happy just getting a double out of it.
But Fold also distinguished himself with his glove during that April 11th game.
A shot toward left center. Fold with a diving catch. Sam Fold makes the grab, and that is some defensive play. Fold hitting home runs, making great catches. Driving in runs, scoring runs, preventing runs from being scored.
Now that Fold has become a folk hero, tales are being told, like the one about him carrying around a baseball statistics book as a third grader.
Yeah, I was. It was something that always interested me for whatever reason. I always loved baseball, and I also had an inclination towards math and numbers, and those two worlds kind of collided with that baseball book that I carried around wherever I went as a little kid.
At age 10, Fold was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, but Super Sam never let it slow him down.
I always was positive with it, and I immediately sought out type 1 diabetic athletes. So I guess the first one that came to mind was Ron Santo, and a couple years later I got a chance to meet Bill Gullickson, who was a pitcher with the Tigers at the time. So it's inevitable that there'll be moments of negativity, but for the most part I just was really positive with it and looked at it as a challenge more than anything.
A challenge that included starting in left field, a position held for a decade by fan favorite Carl Crawford before he departed for Red Sox riches. By mid-April, the Twitter hash mark Legend of Sam Fold cemented his folklore status. There were feature stories in the New York Times and Sports Illustrated. It did not surprise Rays manager Joe Maddon, who says Fold is a high on-base percentage guy who is fearless, despite his batting average coming down to earth.
You would imagine that. A guy not very tall, not very physically strong or gifted, playing in the big leagues as well as he has to have a lot of fight in him. So when he was going through that tough moment, I did not doubt for a second that he's going to fight back, and he has.
Fold still makes spectacular catches in a single bound, leaving his forearm scraped and bruised. And although his batting average has fallen below 250, Maddon says it's easy to stick with the speedy left fielder.
That means a young man obviously fighting against the odds finally gets opportunity and takes advantage of it. Really an easy story, easy man to like. He's every man.
But in some ways, Fold is not your typical ball player. Put aside his 5'10" frame and his type 1 diabetes, his father is a dean at the University of New Hampshire, his mother a state senator, and he graduated from Stanford University. On Super Sam Sunday, in addition to his image being featured on 10,000 blue capes, Fold met after the game with dozens of kids from the local Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Teammate Damon says Fold doesn't need to be Super Sam. Just being plain Sam is good enough.
With his defensive plays, with his bat, he's still helping us win ball games, you know, and it's just not being talked about as much because his average isn't at 380 right now, but even if he's at 220, he's positive for us.
For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in St. Petersburg.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Of course, whilst it's nice to be the best in our region, we have no idea where we stand internationally, but this gives us the opportunity to find out. So spoke Andries Smink, who will lead the Dutch team when the 6th World Egg Throwing Championships commence next month in Mechem, the Netherlands. Events will include distance egg throwing, an egg relay, and something called Russian egg roulette. According to World Egg Throwing Federation President Andy Dunlop, who will act as chief umpire during the competition, this tournament, quote, will show that the ancient sport of egg throwing knows no national boundary. It will draw together world-class athletes in pursuit of excellence. I didn't make any of that up, I swear it.
Eggs.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, gambling on the NBA then and now. But first, the Dallas Mavericks rallied again in the fourth quarter on Thursday and won Game 5 of the NBA Finals by a score of 112-103. Joining me now to talk about the Mavericks and their chance to earn their first ever NBA title is Jean-Jacques Taylor of the Dallas Morning News. Jean-Jacques, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Once again, the Miami Heat held a fourth-quarter lead, and once again, they let it slip away. Where did LeBron James and the Heat disappear to at the end of Game 5?
The Heat don't have an offense. They score all of their points in transition, and at the end of the game, you don't get those opportunities. Whereas the Mavericks are running an offense. Everything's going through Dirk, and they're driving, penetrating, and trying to finish at the rim or kicking it out to their shooters. And so the Mavericks are getting the shots that they want. And so what has happened is it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy. No matter what the score is in the fourth quarter, the Mavericks think they can come back, whether they eventually do or not. And the other team now knows no lead is safe. Whatever we get up, here come the Mavericks. So when you put all that together, I think it's no surprise that they're winning the fourth quarter and that they've put themselves in a position to win a championship that nobody thought they would win, including Mark Cuban and Rick Carlisle, when the season started.
After Thursday morning shoot-around, Dwayne Wade and LeBron James were caught on camera coughing and laughing, apparently mocking Dirk Nowitzki, who's recently played despite having a very high fever as well as an injured finger. I wonder if that was a wise choice by James and Wade.
Well, I mean, it was funny, but I'm not a guy who believes in bulletin board material. I'm not a guy who believes that, oh, they mocked Dirk, and so Dirk sat up there and saw that, and he came and played with even more focus and intensity. This is the finals. This is not about talk. This is about play and performance, and so I thought it was amusing, and all bulletin board material does is if you win, it gives the other team a chance to talk smack after the game. So to me, it wasn't that big a deal outside of being amusing and getting a lot of YouTube hits.
You mentioned that much of the Mavericks' offense has gone through Dirk Nowitzki, but he's had a good deal of help. Tell me a little bit about the cast of characters that's helped him out.
Well, that's part of the problem early was he wasn't getting any help. When they lost Game 1 and Game 3, it's because, in part, Jason Terry went scoreless in the fourth quarter. In their three wins, he scored 8 points in each game, and he has an all-around game that, when he's on it, is very beneficial to the Mavericks. The Mavericks are a team that doesn't really have that one, that normal second scoring option. They rely on a lot of different guys to do it. Sometimes it's J.J. Barea, who's a point guard, got inserted into the starting lineup in Game 4, and his ability to break down the Heat's defense, get in the lane, has really helped the Mavericks. So they've had multiple scoring options all year, and when they win, it's because they're getting various contributions from a lot of different guys outside of Dirk.
Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle played in three NBA finals as a member of the Boston Celtics, and he won a ring in 1986, albeit as a bit player. Is he a championship-caliber coach, in your opinion?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, when you look at the moves he's made, he took Jet Terry out of Game 5 because he missed a couple of screens on a play with 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Benched him, told him, you need to refocus, then I'll put you back in there. A minute later, he put him in there, and Jet played wonderfully down the stretch. And he made a bold move when he put J.J. Barea in the starting lineup after J.J. had struggled. So he's made all the right moves. Guys are making him look good. But his ability to make other players accountable is why he's done a terrific job.
How about those Dallas fans? How are they dealing with the reality that they might be witnessing a championship run by the Mavericks?
I would say if you talk to fans, that they're trying to be much like the players and much like the coaches. They're trying to stay in the moment. I don't think just because you're up 3-2 and going back to Miami that anybody in Dallas thinks, oh, this one's over. It's just a matter of which game we win. I think the crowd and the fans know that it wouldn't take very much. I mean, these games are all going down to the last 2 minutes. So just like the Mavericks have been on the good side three times, there's nothing to say that they go to Miami and with Miami playing at home, where your role players typically play better, that they can't win two games. I mean, I don't think there'd be anybody shocked at all if the Heat won in 7.
What about you? What's your pick with Game 6 on Sunday and, if necessary, Game 7 on Tuesday? Who comes out on top?
When the series starts, started the – I picked the Heat in seven because it's kind of played out the way I thought it would. I thought Dallas would go back up 3-2. But I think if you had to ask me today, I'd say I'd still pick the Heat in seven. But the games have been so close that nothing would surprise me. And all the pressure now is on the Heat. I mean, they're the ones that are expected to win. The Mavericks can play free and easy. And I'm telling you, if the fourth quarter comes around and it's another 2 or 3 point ball game, the Mavericks believe they can win, and I think the Heat are going to be hoping that they can hold on.
Jean-Jacques Taylor writes about sports for the Dallas Morning News. Jean-Jacques, thank you very much for joining me.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Years ago this month, the FBI informed NBA Commissioner David Stern that one of the league's officials was being investigated in connection with a basketball betting operation. The referee involved in providing professional gamblers with information about NBA games, some of which he had worked and bet on, was Tim Donaghy. In Gaming the Game, the story behind the NBA betting scandal and the gambler who made it happen, Sean Patrick Griffin explores the connection between Donaghy and Jimmy Baba Batista, who alleges, among other things, that the NBA failed to discover all that it might have about what Donaghy did and how he did it. Sean Patrick Griffin joins me now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Your major source of information about betting on NBA games and various other sports events was Jimmy Batista. Tell us a little bit about him and how you came to know him.
Jimmy Batista was a professional gambler. In particular, he was what is called a mover. The idea is that no sports book, no bookmaker is ever going to take a $1 million bet, him or herself. And so somebody like Jimmy Batista's expertise was taking big bets, breaking them into small little pieces, and betting them around the world. In that world, getting somebody to get up, go to work every day, be trusted for getting the right bets, not losing money, not stealing money, it's not something that's taken for granted. And very early on, he was considered a very trustworthy person. Interestingly, Batista was never a handicapper. He wouldn't have any better success handicapping a game than I would. And his skill was aligning himself with the best bettors in the world.
How did Jimmy Batista get connected to Tim Donaghy?
Well, their history actually goes back to Cardinal O'Hara High School, which is also in the suburbs of Philadelphia. So they knew each other in high school, but they were not themselves friends. What wound up happening, Tim Donaghy was betting on his own games as early as the end of the 2002-03 NBA season. In 2003, Tim Donaghy was betting with a friend of his, a guy named Jack Kincannon. Jack Kincannon is not a pro gambler. He's just a regular guy. Well, Kincannon was placing his bets with a pro gambler named Pete Ruggieri, who's also based in the suburbs of Philly. You'll notice this whole crowd is all from Delaware County, which is just outside of Philly. And when Pete Ruggieri is placing his bets, he's placing them offshore in Curacao, and the person who's getting the bets is Jimmy Batista.
So the beginning of that relationship between Donaghy and Batista really came when Batista was amazed that anybody was able to make bets with information provided by an NBA ref who was reffing the games they were betting on.
Exactly. And as I describe in the book, according to Batista, the way they discovered there were bets on Tim Donaghy's games was that when Jack Kincannon typically bet NBA games, he would bet $2,000 a game. And all of a sudden in 2003, he starts betting $5,000 a game on certain games. And those $5,000 per game are winning at a ridiculous rate. And it doesn't take long to realize, oh my goodness, those are games Tim Donaghy's officiating, and they knew that Jack Kincannon was friends with Donaghy. So they were smart. They just simply started copying the bets that Jack Kincannon was placing.
What was the time frame during which Donaghy and Batista did business together?
In the fall of 2006, Jimmy Batista was on the outs with his wife, and as a result of that had moved in temporarily with Tommy Martino. He was the third conspirator in the 06-07 portion of the scandal. Well, as Batista is living with Martino, Tim Donaghy is calling Martino constantly, and he's complaining about Jack Kincannon not paying on bets. As a result of which, Jimmy Batista and Tommy Martino schedule a meeting with Donaghy, and it's at that fateful meeting that Donaghy, Martino, and Bautista decide that Donaghy is no longer going to bet with Jack and Cannon, that he's now going to switch to betting directly with Jimmy Bautista, which is important. The important thing about pro gamblers, they actually manipulate betting lines by betting the wrong side of a proposition and watching what they call the sucker money follow the bets. So he may have invested, let's say, $30,000 on the wrong side waiting for the line to move, and now he'll bet $1 million on the other side once the line is where he wanted it. And so having direct access to Donaghy for somebody like Bautista was invaluable because now he could really maximize his access to the referee.
Jimmy Bautista refers to Tim Donaghy as Elvis. Why is that?
Because he was the king.
Simple.
Pro gamblers, if they win at a 56% rate, they're thrilled. When they bet on Donaghy's games, they won 78% of the time, and he had never seen anything like that. And so for him, Donaghy was the king.
It would be logical to assume that Tim Donaghy would try to affect games in which he was an official if he had bet on those games, but Donaghy said that he never did that. Did you find that contention believable?
No. And by the way, neither did the FBI. When Donaghy pleaded guilty, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office made him admit that his financial interest in the outcomes of games may have altered his on-court performance. They refused to sign his deal unless he made that admission. Now, that has not stopped him from insisting that he didn't alter game outcomes. There are all sorts of problems with Donaghy's story once you had a chance to assess it. For instance, he claimed in the 06-07 season, which is the season that involved Bautista and Martino, that he bet on 16 games he officiated and 14 that he didn't. And that, of course, is a very important contention because if it really was true that inside information alone accounted for his betting success, it wouldn't matter if he was officiating or not. There's no evidence whatsoever that supports that contention. And there's something even less sophisticated that no one caught. Donaghy said to the feds, and Bautista and Martino also agree with this, that they had a code. And the code was mom and dad. Mom for home team. Dad, you're going to pick the away team. Well, if there are six NBA games that night, and Tim Donaghy calls Tommy Martino to place his bet, how would he know what team to pick out of the six games being played that night if he simply said, Mom? It only works if you know the game you're going to bet. And, of course, the games were games Donaghy was officiating.
Having researched the Donaghy case and spoken really at great length with Jimmy Bautista over a period of time, do you think Donaghy was simply a rogue referee, or are other officials likely to have done or be doing what he did?
Oh, I absolutely believe Donaghy was a rogue referee. There's a ton of inside information being traded as currency among pro gamblers. They really do have sources, whether it's journalists or trainers and things like that. People who often owe debts to gamblers and bookmakers, and their way of paying the debt back isn't money. It's by giving inside information. That goes on a lot. As far as altering game outcomes, that's why these pro gamblers couldn't believe what was happening. They had never seen anything like this before.
Jimmy Bautista told you at one point that it was a good thing he got caught when he did, because if he'd been able to keep operating as he'd been operating, and if the authorities had landed him somewhere later down the line, quote, it would have been the biggest sports scandal in history. Was he just celebrating his own notoriety, or was there something to that assertion?
That's another great question. I think part of it really was celebrating his notoriety, but he knew who all of his inside sources were. Especially in college, as I explain in the book, obviously the focus is on the NBA betting scandal. But going back years, Bautista and certain people with whom he worked had great sources in college sports. Had somebody actually taken the time to realize what he was doing and where he was getting information, it would have been the biggest scandal. The FBI, when they first visit him, they tell him that they think that he's involved with inside information. And I think they're expecting him to deny this. And he, of course, proudly says, yeah, that's what I do. I'm pretty well known for getting inside information. I trade it. And what he told me when I was interviewing, when I referenced that exchange, he swears he had no idea what they were referring to. He didn't know that they were talking about Donaghy because it could have been any number of things.
Jimmy Bautista, Tommy Martino, and Tim Donaghy all went to jail in late 2008. Where are they now?
All three men served their time in prison. What I hear is that Bautista is managing a fitness club. Tommy Martino is working at his brother's hair salon. Tim Donaghy is the interesting one. He's the only one I can say conclusively what he's doing because he's been so public about it. On the one hand, he is lending his services as a consultant and as a speaker about the ills of gambling addiction. And as he's doing that, he's working for an online handicapping service providing his picks.
You write that the NBA never fully explored the betting operation in which Tim Donaghy was involved, certainly not to the extent that you did. What should the league have done that it didn't do?
I love that question. When they started their study, it was called the Pedowitz Study. An attorney in Brooklyn who was a former U.S. attorney himself, Larry Pedowitz, was hired to do this. Neither Batista nor Martino nor Donaghy would speak with him, and the feds didn't speak with him, nor did they allow him access to any of the files. So from the start, the NBA study was at best superficial. So that's not their fault. The only thing they really could have done was look at individual level referee call data. If they've done a thorough study, it's news to me. With respect to the betting line data and the betting records, that's unassailable. That's not he said, he said. I mean, the numbers are the numbers.
What about the other pro sports leagues and the big-time college programs? Have they learned anything from the Donaghy scandal and all that's come from it?
Well, you would hope so. The NFL for years has had their ears to the ground, so to speak, following betting lines. I don't know what the other pro sports do. Of course, the NBA was not, we now know, and they should have been, because that really is a tip-off. The betting lines don't lie. And with modern technology, you or I can quite easily, with a mouse and a computer, can pretty well tell if something's odd. The problem is everybody has been so tight-lipped about what they're doing. You know, I had way more success talking to federal investigators than I did about anybody in the NBA or in Las Vegas sportsbooks. So I can't tell you with any degree of certainty how serious people are, you know, ferreting this out.
Sean Patrick Griffin is the author of Gaming the Game, the story behind the NBA betting scandal and the gambler who made it happen. The book is published by Barricade, and the author joined me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Sean, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Looked at me with that familiar desire, and her eyes lit up. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Queenie was an elephant that used to water ski. That may not seem quite right to you, and it may not to me, but Queenie, who was 59, did water ski a lot. She did it in the 50s and the 60s, and she got attention for so doing. She drew crowds and heard the cheers. But now the skiing Queenie has passed through this veil of tears. She cashed her chips in Georgia at a theme park where she dwelt. And this week, everyone who'd seen her ski has likely felt a pang at Queenie's passing, which is how it has to be for Queenie, that old elephant who liked to water ski. Go, go, go. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the reigning team from Spain gets off the plane and rains on the U.S. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
A lot of allegedly intelligent observers thought that the Miami Heat would overwhelm the Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals. It hasn't turned out that way. According to that bastion of sports reporting, the Wall Street Journal, Dallas has a secret weapon. What is it?
They touch each other.
There you go.
They slap themselves high fives. They're very, you know, very physically, emotionally demonstrative with each other. And that's supposed to be indicating, according to dozens of scientific researchers who I'm sure have better things to do, that's supposed to be a big deal. Basically, what I think is the problem is that a lot of the Miami Heat shooting in the fourth quarter doesn't touch the rim, which is not a good thing.
Well, the Heat must win both of the remaining NBA Finals games at home to win the series. You've made it clear that you think LeBron and Dwayne are really good at playing basketball, but they've not been able to close out these games against Dallas. Will it be different starting tomorrow?
I think they're going to win the two games in Miami. I think the next game is going to be very close, but then they'll win it, and I think they'll win the championship in a game seven that'll be fairly comfortable. It's very strange. It's looking right now as though Dwayne Wade is fed up with LeBron James, and it's an odd dynamic to watch on the floor.
On Wednesday, Charles Barkley called the Miami Heat, quote, a whiny bunch, and he criticized the Heat's fans as well. Did he have a point, or was this just Charles looking for ink?
It's Charles looking for ink, but he does have a point. They do have a certain level of entitlement when the whistle blows.
This week, the NHL's interim discipline guy, Mike Murphy, ruled that the hit that took Boston's Nathan Horton out of the Stanley Cup Finals with a severe concussion was not a, quote, blindside hit under the league's new Rule 48, but he suspended Vancouver's Aaron Rome for four games anyway. The NHL general managers are now reportedly talking about expanding the rule to close that loophole. Good idea?
Yes, because the NHL is looking ridiculous in the national spotlight again. The NHL has made a science of looking ridiculous in the national spotlight over the last 30 years. This is just the latest thing. Who cares whether it was blindsided? It was a deliberate blow to the head. And Aaron Rome should be suspended for all of the playoffs of this year, half of next year, and he should be allowed to apply for reinstatement next February.
One might assume, Charlie, that the son of Wayne Gretzky, one of the greatest hockey players of all time, would grow up to become a hockey player, but then one would be wrong, right?
Yeah, he's a baseball player. He got drafted by the Cubs in the seventh round of the MLB draft. I mean, he may be what they've been waiting for. They've been waiting for the child of Wayne Gretzky to lead them.
Red Sox slugger David Ortiz got plunked on Thursday night for the first time in 696 plate appearances, and he doesn't blame pitcher C.C. Sabathia for hitting him. Who does he blame?
Who else but the media for pointing it out? Yeah. It is kind of a na-na-na-na-na-na-boo-boo moment for the media and the Yankee pitching staff. I mean, when living in a dormitory in college, they posted the semester-length damage for each floor in the main lobby of the building, and our floor had no damage. And of course, what happened in the next half hour? Somebody rode the elevator up to 11 and threw a brick through our TV room window. So yes, if you do publish these kind of streaks, somebody will generally, you know, commit vandalism upon them fairly quickly.
On Monday, the BCS stripped the University of Southern California football team of their 2004 national title because USC's Reggie Bush had broken various rules. This led to the assumption that Oklahoma might inherit that national title, but the head coach there, Bob Stoops, said, no, thank you very much. Is the NCAA going to have trouble giving away this trophy?
Well, I mean, I guess they can, in their official record books, they can indicate that Oklahoma is the national champion now. I give Bob Stoops a little credit for not wanting a trophy his team didn't earn.
Last week, we talked about ex-Ohio State football coach Jim Tressel, whose failure to curb various behaviors among his players led to his resignation. This week, I guess his job prospects are looking up.
Yes, apparently some CEOs like the way he does business at Ohio State. A guy who's the CEO of a beverage company is surrendering his own salary to Tressel's charity, whatever charity Tressel might indicate, up to and including his legal fund, I suppose, to get Tressel on the advisory board of the soda company. So may not pass NCAA muster, but the Forbes 500, they're loving them some Jim Tressel.
Meanwhile, Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie sounds like he would rather turn down the honor of hosting the NFL's annual Pro Bowl. How do you like his reasoning?
I like his reasoning a great deal. He says you can't give $4 million to a $9 billion football industry and not give any money to children. I mean, obviously the budget crunch in Hawaii is as bad as it is in most states. Good for him. I hope they have to play the Pro Bowl in Roger Goodell's living room this year.
This would mean that an even larger number than normal players would say,
Thank you very much, I have an ankle injury. That's right. My back is hurting me.
Charlie, people pay more attention to the Belmont Stakes in years when the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness have been won by the same horse. Of course, there will be no Triple Crown winner this year, but would you like to tell us which horse will win the Belmont this afternoon?
Absolutely not, because I'm no good at picking horse races, but the horse I'm rooting for is Master of Hounds.
It's kind of an English sound
yes,
to it.
Yes, I want Master of Hounds.
Sporting KC.
Of course, there's a horse called Shackleford, but he's going to get lost and come walking around the finish line in 6 months. Master of Hounds.
Is that Shackleton or Shackleford?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was I think it was Shackleton. I'm a little bit shackled up here.
He's going to be lost and
cold. I'm completely shackled at this point. Let's move on. Master of Hounds!
Sporting KC, Major League Soccer's franchise in Kansas City, is now playing in a brand new soccer-specific stadium, which is called...
Growth Hormone Ballpark.
It's soccer we're talking about here. Livestrong Sporting Park. Any risk in that particular naming rights choice?
Well, Livestrong is, of course, associated with Lance Armstrong, who is having his own problems with doping scandals right now. So they're sort of riding on the ragged edge. I don't have a problem with just keeping the name Livestrong. I remember when Enron collapsed and took so many people with it, the only bill that Enron actually paid in the middle of its bankruptcy before its people all went to jail was the naming rights on the ballpark in Houston. And you pointed out earlier, AIG is still out there proudly on the shirts of Manchester United.
Yeah, for a long time, man, you had AIG on their shirts and played pretty well anyway.
I mean, that's tantamount to having, like, cholera written across there. I think Wayne Rooney is probably owned by some vice president of Goldman Sachs right now and doesn't even know it.
And finally, we've discussed creative promotions at minor league baseball games lots and lots of times, but for covering all the bases, so to speak, have you ever encountered a promotion that can compete with a package deal offered by the Quad City River Bandits?
I love the Quad City River Bandits. They have the Circle of Life promotional series. They begin with maternity night. A mother of a newborn will get a prize pack, including, you know, a new stroller, a crib, a car seat, and a whole lot of other things. There's a wedding giveaway and a scholarship giveaway. And we conclude at the end of the Circle of Life promotional series, they're giving away a free funeral. Now, presumably, one does not have to take advantage of the free funeral right away. And there isn't sort of like a time limit on when you can pick up your prize.
Yeah, I would hope so.
I'd hate to feel obligated to die so my family could get the free funeral.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Master of Hounds!
A couple of weeks ago, we featured a story about a spelling bee for adults held in a bar in Louisville, Kentucky. In response, Rick Wren emailed as follows, "I was delighted to hear the story, but I'd like you to know that we've been doing virtually the same thing at our bar, Mr. Toad, in Omaha." Mr. Wren, who listens to the program on KIOS in Omaha, was not dismayed that another bar running a spelling bee got the free publicity. He wrote, "We are content that there seems to be a group of us committed to raising the literacy rate of sops and tipplers." Last Saturday's story on the fencing tournament in Fort Ticonderoga, New York, drew lots of responses from people glad that we'd paid some attention to what they regard as a neglected sport. The story also, quote, jogged the memory of John Wilde of Greenwood, South Carolina. He wrote, 40 years ago, when I was a librarian at the University of Winnipeg, I hired a young Mennonite woman as a periodicals assistant. One day she wandered by a fencing practice. Curiosity led her to pick up a foil. Before she knew it, she was on the college team, though the coach had to enroll her in a couple of courses to make it kosher. She showed real aptitude, but eventually returned to her roots and enrolled in a Mennonite Bible college. God's gain was fencing's loss. My commentary, available at onlyagame.org, on gratuitous violence in pro hockey provoked various responses on the website and on our Facebook page. "Spot on," wrote Joseph Moore. "What will it take to get it under control? Someone dying there on the ice in front of 18,000 fans? A listener named Aaron felt the same way and wrote, "Thank you. It's nice to know that someone likes hockey for hockey. I would certainly be more of a fan if they cut the excess violence." On the other hand, Izzo10914 began his or her comment with, "I'm sorry, but you are stupid," and went on to contend as follows. "Fighting is part of hockey. Hockey is a tough sport. You have to be able to handle pain to play. If you get rid of the big hits in fighting, it's not hockey anymore." You can drop the gloves in response to anything you've heard on our program or read on the website. Visit onlyagame.org to do so, or leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio.
Todo. Joab, no entre.
A week ago Thursday, as Spain's national soccer team worked out in Foxborough, Massachusetts, in preparation for last Saturday's game against the U.S. national team, the players must have been exhausted, or at least the six of them who play for FC Barcelona must have been. They'd had just 4 days to recover from the celebration after they'd beaten Manchester United at Wembley Stadium to win the Champions Cup. But the workout was lively, and for longtime soccer fan Peter Wheelton, who'd brought his 9-year-old daughter Emmeline and her friend Evan to the practice, it may have been inspirational.
I'm out here just for the pure enjoyment of the moment and of the game and having the kids be excited. And, you know, to watch the best team in the world warm up and get ready for a game is just a treat.
When he called Spain the best team in the world, Peter Wheelton wasn't exaggerating. They are defending World Cup champions. But as the members of the Spanish team gathered for the visit to the U.S., observers familiar with the composition of the team wondered how well some of the players might perform together. That's because the six Barcelona players on the national team were joined by five men who played for Real Madrid, including team captain Iker Casillas. Barcelona secured first place in Spain's La Liga, where Madrid was second, by beating Madrid. Madrid won the Copa del Rey, Spain's national tournament, by beating Barcelona in a game where the soccer was uncharacteristically ragged and physical.
And now a chance for Barcelona to break quickly. David Villa falls over Abaloa. And perhaps a lash out there from Abaloa. And it's all blowing out of proportion now at the Mestalla. Tensions boiling over. This is
now shortly thereafter, Barcelona knocked off their rivals in the more significant Champions League competition all over the course of just 17 days this spring. During a midweek press conference, Spain's head coach, Vicente del Bosque, said there are no issues on this team. But in the Gillette Stadium press box before last Saturday's game, Sports Illustrated writer Grant Wall shook his head as he recalled the worst moments of the four Barcelona-Madrid matches.
There was some real bad blood going on. You could see it on the field in those games, too. They were not fun games to watch for the most part, and there was a lot of fouling, pushing, complaining. You know, you're also dealing with the national team in Spain of tremendous political tensions over the years between Barcelona and Madrid and Catalans and Castilians and all that stuff.
All that stuff includes a history that saw Francisco Franco embrace Real Madrid while residents of Barcelona energetically opposed the dictator's long rule. The tensions of that era have eased, certainly, but as I walked among the fans in the Gillette Stadium parking lot before last Saturday's game, it became apparent that they haven't entirely disappeared. Witness the testimony of one Jose Camacho.
I am from Madrid. I hate the people from Barcelona. Today we are a team. No, we love the Barcelona people in here. But that's it.
Mr. Camacho's sentiments are based on an understanding of nationalism and geography not uncommon in Madrid.
Barcelona is not Spain. That is the first thing, okay? No, and we recognize that they are not from Spain. But when they play for they don't have a national team. We do. So we share our national team with the Catalans, okay? And they are very welcome to play with us because they play very well.
Once the game began, it quickly became apparent that whatever issues may have still existed between the Barcelona players and those employed by Real Madrid had been subordinated to the business of playing well together. As a result, fans of the U.S. team who had hoped for a competitive game were disappointed. Spain controlled the ball throughout most of the first half, which ended with the U.S. down 3-0. A young man named Gonzalo, who was born in Zaragoza, Spain, but is studying in the U.S., was delighted by how well his countrymen were playing as a team.
There was a lot in the press in Spain, so we're happy that nothing happened and that they can get along with each other.
And score 3 goals.
Definitely. That's just the beginning, though. That's just the beginning.
The second half offered less of the same. Spain continued to control much of the play, but mercifully they scored only one more goal. In the wake of the 4-0 drubbing that could have been worse, Santiago Cazorla, who scored twice, was asked if he was happy with his performance and if it had been an easy game for Spain.
Yes, to be able to score was great, and to be able to warm up the stadium. I hope I'll be able to keep contributing to the team because that's what it's all about. But no, it seems easy, but it wasn't. It was a challenging game, and this is our final trip, our last effort before we get a vacation, so we have to give it our all.
That vacation will be hard-earned and well-deserved, even for the players whose teams didn't play for as long as Barcelona did. After Saturday's game, the Spanish team moved on to another friendly against Venezuela, whom they beat 3-0 Tuesday night. The U.S. team played on Tuesday night as well, and they managed to put the loss to Spain behind them and blank Canada 2-0 in their opening game in the Gold Cup tournament, a regional competition. Like Senor Cazorla, the U.S. players would probably politely deny that thumping Canada seemed easy after the lopsided affair during which they'd chased Spain for 90 minutes, but perhaps it did. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Amy Littlefield, Peter Lydodes, Jeremy Bernfeld, and from Shea Walker at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our intern is Allison Gluck, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my Spain soccer photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Jean-Jacques Taylor of the Dallas Morning News, who characterizes the demeanor of Miami Heat fans during home games.
Hey, show us what you got, and if you show us something, then we'll get involved.
Well, what do you expect when your best players are Dwayne and LeBron? I think skepticism's probably in order. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
A la Madrid, a triunfar en buena lid, defendiendo tu color. A la Madrid, a la Madrid, a la Madrid.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.